It's Friday, September 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. So glad you could join us today. Coming up, Kenya's Supreme Court overturned Uhuru Kenyatta's victory. Also, massive flooding in South Asia.
Bangladesh, Nepal, and the eastern region of India, this is really in the Himalayan foothills, are suffering some of their worst flooding.
U.S. Vice President tours the area of massive U.S. flooding.
The road to recovery will be long and difficult, but as the president said, we will endure.
And millions mark the high point of the Hajj. That's all this hour on International Edition. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta said Friday that he would honor the Supreme Court ruling that nullified his election win last month, even though he personally disagrees with the decision. While he said he would accept the ruling, Kenyatta criticized the court, saying, quote, six people have decided they will go against the will of the people. Kenya's Supreme Court nullified the results of the election due to irregularities and illegalities committed by the Electoral Board during the vote. David Maraga is the Chief Justice of Kenya.
The presidential election held on 8th August 2017 was not conducted in accordance with the Constitution and the applicable law, rendering the declared results invalid, null, and void.
Opposition leader Raila Odinga had petitioned the court to throw out the results of the August vote. Odinga says the results that had him losing to Kenyatta by about 1.4 million votes were false.
This is a triumph for the people of Kenya. And we said at the beginning that our journey to Canaan was unstoppable. On the 8th of August, we crossed the River Jordan. We reached the city of Jericho. We are marching on to the city of Jerusalem, and we shall get there. As has been said by my other colleagues, we have no faith at all in the Electoral Commission as currently constituted. They have committed criminal acts. Most of them actually belong to the jail. And therefore, we are going to ask for prosecution of all the Electoral Commission officers who have caused this monstrous crime against the people of Kenya.
Kenya's constitution says that fresh elections must now be held in 60 days. The United States has ordered Russia to close some of its diplomatic facilities in the U.S. White House spokesman Sarah Huckabee Sanders.
Right now, we're requiring the Russian government to close its consulate general in San Francisco, a trade annex in Washington, D.C., and a trade annex in New York City. These closures have to be completed by the September 2nd. We've taken a firm and measured action in response to Russia's unfortunate decision earlier this year. We want to halt the downward spiral, and we want to move forward to towards better relations. We'll look for opportunities to do that, but we also want to have equity in the decisions and anything beyond that. I would refer you to the State Department.
The action by Washington was a move Moscow greeted with regret as relations between the two nuclear-armed powers took another dive. At the U.S. State Department, they said the decision was made in the spirit of parity after Moscow, in July, ordered a dramatic reduction of U.S. diplomatic staff in Russia. And that came after Moscow ordered dramatic cuts in the U.S. staff following new congressionally approved sanctions. Among the top stories in the world at this hour, Kenya's Supreme Court overturns the recent presidential election results. The U.S. demands Russia cut its staff working in the U.S. Rescue operations continue along the U.S. Gulf Coast following Hurricane Harvey. Monsoons take the lives of over 1,200 in South Asia. And the security in Mecca tightens at the height of the Hajj. Leaders of the world's largest emerging economies, the so-called BRICS nation, that stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, gather for a summit this Sunday in the Chinese city of Xiamen. Underlying the meeting might be the persistent rivalry between the two most populous countries, China and India. Both recently resolved a border dispute, but tensions remain over India's sanctuary of Tibet's spiritual leader, the Dalai Lama. Scott Kennedy, who directs the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Washington-based Center of Strategic and International Studies, told VOA's Victor Beatty that the two objectives he sees are the ability of China and India to overcome tensions and an effort to broaden the agenda of BRICS.
I don't think we ought to see the BRICS group as an alternative to the G7 or G20 or the Bretton Woods system. I do think it is an effort by China and these others to have a higher global profile, to have an organization that represents a large proportion of the world's population and GDP that doesn't include the United States. But substantively, there's still lots of differences between these countries. Their political systems are different as well. So far, it is more symbolism than a real significant challenge.
Scott, a professor at the Center for East Asian Studies at the Jawaharlal Nehru University, said the timing of this summit is significant, coming as the U.S. under President Trump appears to be abandoning the traditional global order.
This is the fifth summit, and so it's been going on, you know, for several years. I think there is a question about the U.S.'s role globally. And what we are seeing as a consequence of the new administration's policies is a lot more self-help activity by countries around the world, countries willing to take more risks, and other organizations that are acting together, standing out in contrast to American behavior. Those are things to be concerned about. The solutions are a more active, engaged United States, not pushing China to be less involved globally.
You mentioned India-China tensions, of course, regarding India's hosting of the Tibetan spiritual leader, as well as their most recent border tension. Are these tensions going to predominate? Do you think this will be a good forum for them to ease those tensions?
My guess is that during the BRICS summit, they're going to paper over these differences. They are quite significant. They're reflective of broader strategic differences, different views about Tibet and political systems, but they're not going to get through this weekend, you know, trying to solve these things. I think they're going to try and put those aside for the moment, put on a good face. But when this is over, they will have the same problems that they did face. And I think that's why people shouldn't put too much into the BRICS as an organization with a big mission. I think it's still grasping for one, and it may always be in that state.
Scott Kennedy of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was speaking with our colleague, VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Live from Washington, you're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Doug Bernard. The southern U.S. region isn't the only place in the world struggling with major flooding. Monsoons in South Asia have claimed more than 1,200 lives so far this season. A condemned building collapsed in the Indian financial hub of Mumbai after torrential rains this week battered away at the 117-year-old structure where many poor people lived. Correspondent Anjana Pasricha in New Delhi spoke with my colleague Ira Melman about the heavy rains throughout the region, plus the rescue efforts underway in Mumbai.
It was a huge operation. About 200 rescuers have been at work. They've been hammering at the concrete slabs to rescue those trapped inside. It was very difficult to mount the rescue because, you know, this building is in a very old, crowded market. And the narrow roads made it difficult to bring in cranes and bulldozers, but they did do so finally. Local residents also tried to help moving the rubble with bare hands. That usually happens in India. People sort of come and try to rescue everybody. But you know, this whole incident also shines the light on a city where real estate prices are so high that poor people cannot afford to relocate, even when buildings are declared unsafe.
Now, Mumbai, as we know, is a mega city, about 20 million people, and it's just about at sea level. Is there an overall flooding problem there with a lot of rain?
Absolutely. Mumbai's problem of flooding is very distinct from what South Asia is suffering. This was a case of urban flooding, basically caused by very poor urban planning that has resulted in choking the drainage system in the city, as you say, of 20 million people. So on Tuesday, when it received as much rain in a day as it does on an average in a month, it sort of virtually drowned in knee-deep water, with traffic coming to a near halt, roads turning into rivers, and many people could not even leave their offices. They stayed overnight. You know, the city's largest hospital was also partially flooded. Basically, as I told you, it is a problem caused by the fact that its drainage system has not been looked after. There has been unchecked construction on coastal areas. Stormwater drains and waterways are clogged by garbage. And so waterlogging is a perennial problem. Obviously, when it rains heavily, then the city gets flooded. The civic authorities have come in for a lot of flak. There are questions raised every year before the monsoons. Are they prepared? But unfortunately, the city continues to suffer.
I'm trying to make comparisons to what's happening in Texas with that hurricane and what's happening over there. And I guess there are major differences. Is that correct?
There would be major differences because I think the people affected here are much poorer. They live in small homes which have been washed away. Their farmland has been washed away. This means lost crops, lost incomes, and a year of deprivation. Many of these families own very small plots of land. They don't have money stashed away to help them tide over a crisis. They will also be coping with lack of clean water and sanitation, which could, in the weeks and months ahead, lead to a spike in deadly diarrhea and malaria cases, with which, in many cases, they have no ways of coping. They do not have easy access to hospitals or medical care centers. They will be very heavily reliant on aid agencies and local governments trying to help them out.
We're getting reports that there is flooding basically in many, many areas of South Asia. What can you tell us about that?
Yes. You know, Bangladesh, Nepal, and the eastern region of India, this is really in the Himalayan foothills, are suffering some of their worst flooding. This is triggered by heavy monsoon rains and overflowing rivers that cascade down to the plains from the Himalayas. From reports that we have, about a third of Nepal is submerged. Huge areas of Bangladesh are inundated, and three states in India, in the northeast and east, are also witnessing flood havoc. Of course, it's poor communities who are affected the worst. You know, they are the ones who live in the floodplains. Some villages are completely cut off, and the only way to get food and other aid to them is by boat. That's what we are told by the aid agencies. You know, the monsoon season runs from June to September, but we have seen some heavy rain in August that has led to the inundation, to the rivers swelling up and overflowing, and to the situation that we have today. A bulk of the casualties, 1,200 people are supposed to have died, are in India, and the rest in Bangladesh and Nepal. In addition to 1 million homes being washed away, about 18,000 schools have been damaged, and it's rural communities which are affected the most.
New Delhi-based correspondent Anjana Pasricha speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Well, turning to the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey in the Gulf Coast, even though the rains in Houston have stopped virtually, many neighborhoods near dams and rivers are still experiencing flooding conditions. From around Texas and beyond, volunteers who connected through social media are in boats giving a helping hand. They say what's happening in Texas is a good model for lawmakers in Washington. VOA's Elizabeth Lee spent the day with some rescuers in Houston.
What is now a river was once a road and railroad tracks just a few days ago. Volunteers have been combing flooded neighborhoods looking for people who are trapped in their homes.
We went to downtown Houston, rescued some people who are stuck in their homes still because a levee broke down there, so we try and get them out as fast as we could.
A child of Vietnamese immigrants, Peter Chow says these volunteers may not know each other, but he sees them all as family.
No matter what color or race, everyone out there was on several boats. No matter what color or race, we're there as Houstonians, Texans, helping each other out.
So we need to give her another thing of diapers.
helping people like Debbie Winters, who lost everything in the flood.
It was up to the second floor in our house, went up to the third floor in our house. The family got out, but my boyfriend did stay to try to protect the house. Then he had to be rescued by boat.
But with news of burglars and looters, not everyone wants to leave their homes.
We ran this river yesterday, found some people on their second-story balconies, but they weren't willing to get off, so there's nothing we can do about that.
On this trip, Justin Elbert and his crew found an evacuated neighborhood in North Houston with a couple of stragglers that needed rescuing.
After watching the news and seeing all the negativity going around the U.S., this shows right here, an event like this, that Americans can come together and help each other out and be one.
If the Democrats and the Republicans and the judicial branch and the executive branch can't understand that a bunch of people who have 9-to-5 jobs come together and rescue people in the greatest time of need, that right now when our country is in the greatest time of need for itself, they need to get together and they need to work together like we are.
Everyone here is family.
Family across cultural and political backgrounds who will continue to give a helping hand in the days to come. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Houston.
And you can keep up to date with the flooding, whether in the U.S. or South Asia, and all the day's other news at our website, voanews.com. Around 2 million Muslim pilgrims are marking the high point of the Hajj. That's the annual Islamic pilgrimage to Mecca by ascending Mount Arafat in Saudi Arabia. Edward Uranian reports that Saudi security forces remain on high alert amid a variety of internal and external terrorist threats.
Tens of thousands of Muslim pilgrims made the ritual ascent to the Namira Mosque on Mount Arafat outside Mecca, braving a blazing summer sun and temperatures hovering around 40 degrees Celsius. Saudi television showed a sea of pilgrims cloaked in white cloth robes, many clutching umbrellas to shield them from the sun, climbing Mount Arafat, where Islam's Prophet Muhammad is thought to have given his final sermon. Sheikh Saad al-Shitri, addressing them at the mosque, told them the pilgrimage should be focused on God.
يجب أن يجعل الحج لله وحده. قال تعالى وأتموا الحج والعمرة.
He says the Hajj must be dedicated to God alone, and that there can be no place for political or sectarian strife, which has resulted in horrible massacres and left millions homeless. Prince Khalid al-Faisal, Emir of Mecca, told journalists the Saudi government has done its utmost to ensure the comfort and safety of the pilgrims attending this year's Hajj.
بالنسبة لهيئة تطوير مكة فهي جهزت قطار المشاعر.
He says the Saudi Hajj Authority has provided 21,000 tour buses, a shuttle train that can carry 360,000 pilgrims, and provided for health concerns with 30,000 doctors and nurses, 17 hospitals, 35 emergency rooms, and 135 mobile health centers. Thousands of Saudi security personnel dressed in black held training drills overnight to ensure their readiness for possible problems. Saudi Interior Minister Prince Abdulaziz bin Saud said several days ago his ministry and others are cooperating to make sure the pilgrimage takes place safely and without any glitches. He says several government ministries and private organizations have cooperated to make the Hajj go off smoothly and ensure the pilgrims' comfort and safety. Pilgrims were spending Thursday night in the Valley of Muzdalifah after slowly descending Mount Arafat. The Hajj concludes Friday as pilgrims sacrifice an animal. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
A report known as the Cluster Munition Monitor has condemned the continued use of cluster munitions by Syria and Yemen. The report says the number of attacks has increased since Russia began joint military operations with Syrian forces in 2015. Mary Wareham is an advisory director with Human Rights Watch's Arms Division. She says that Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov neither denies nor confirms Russian use of weapons in Syria, although she adds Lavrov does deny that they have been used indiscriminately.
When cluster munitions are dropped from the air or launched from the ground, they fall over a wide area, and civilians caught up in that are harmed. That's indiscriminate use. There is no way that cluster munitions can be used discriminately. So Russia, we believe, is on the losing side of that argument, and it's holding on to a weapon that the rest of the world has firmly rejected.
More than 100 countries have joined the treaty, known as the Cluster Munitions Convention, since it took effect in August 2010. This is VOA News. Finally today, actor Mark Ruffalo has joined activists marching from the U.S. city of Charlottesville, Virginia, to the nation's capital to condemn white supremacy recently on display in the Virginia city. In a statement, the actor says he's marching in memory of Heather Heyer, who died when a car plowed into a group of people protesting the white nationalist rally in Charlottesville on August 12th. Ruffalo also condemned President Trump's response that, quote, both sides were to blame for the violence. Ruffalo says there's no place for racism, violence, and hatred in the country. Organizers said they had to stop a portion of the march this week because they received threats of an armed person waiting for them along the route. And briefly revisiting our top story at this hour, Kenyans reacted with celebration, frustration, and shock Friday after that country's Supreme Court, in a 4-2 decision, ordered a do-over of last month's presidential election, the court ruling that the Independent Election and Boundaries Commission was responsible for, quote, irregularities and illegalities in the transmission of election results. Well, that is International Edition for this September 1st, the first day of meteorological autumn. We hope it's a good one for you. We hope you have a great weekend. Thanks so much for listening.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including the Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Sikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net. or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.